Welcome to Irregular Climate, where we take a look at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism. On this week's show, some good news and some sad news. IOPO no, it's not about saving the planet. The Skeptic Debunk of the Week and Ken Cuccinelli Doesn't Know When to Quit. I am Dan Mutal. First, some good news and an update to the Prawngate story of last week. For those of you who didn't listen to last week's show, shame on you. No, not really. But a quick recap is that Monckton gave a presentation, John Abraham demolished the points in that presentation, and now Monckton is trying to censor John Abraham. He's encouraging his followers and the followers of the notoriously inaccurate What's Up With That blog to flood the inboxes of the administrators of St. Thomas University, where Abraham is a professor, and demanding disciplinary action that would infringe upon John Abraham's academic freedom. And John Abraham is not the only one who has been intimidated by Monckton. Barry Bickmore at Brigham Young University has also been intimidated by Monckton, as has Naomi Oreskes of UC San Diego. John Abraham's presentation was well-cited and accurate. There is no reason for anyone to demand any action against John Abraham for debunking Monckton's claims. The good news is that all indications are that John Abraham is being vigorously backed up by his university. But we still need to show our support. John Abraham won't be the last scientist intimidated by people like Monckton. And we need to send a clear message to all scientists that if they step into the fray, they will be backed up by a large community who is willing to stand up for science and stand up against intimidation of scientists. So please join the Prawngate Facebook group. It's already up to almost 500 members at the time of this recording, probably now over 500 members, and support science, support John Abraham, and support anyone else who is intimidated by the people like Monckton. We're sick and tired of the intimidation from denialists, and we're not going to take it anymore. And now some sad news. Earlier this week, Stephen Schneider died of a heart attack. Schneider was perhaps one of the most well-known and respected scientists studying the Earth's climate. He had an amazing ability to communicate the complexities of climate science in a manner accessible to almost everyone. But perhaps most important of all his qualities was the fact that he was not afraid to stand up for science and denounce denialism. This is something that is far too rare, even today, in the scientific community. At Real Climate, a fellow climate scientist named Ben Santer wrote a touching eulogy, which I suggest you all read, but I'll highlight some of it now. Stephen Schneider did more than any other individual on the planet to help us realize that human actions have led to the global scale changes in Earth's climate. Steve was instrumental in focusing scientific, political, and public attention on one of the major challenges facing humanity, the problem of human-caused climate change. Steve had a rare gift of being able to explain the complexities of climate science in plain English. He could always find the right story, the right metaphor, the right way of distilling difficult ideas and concepts down to their essence. Through his books, his extensive public speaking, and his many interactions with the media, Steve did for climate science what Carl Sagan did for astronomy. Steve Schneider epitomized scientific courage. He was fearless. The pathway he chose to be a scientific leader, to be a leader in scientific communication, and to fully embrace the interdisciplinary nature of the climate change problem was not an easy pathway. Yet without the courage of leaders like Stephen Schneider, the world would not be on the threshold of agreeing to radically change the way we use energy. We would not be on the verge of a global treaty to limit the emissions of greenhouse gases. We honor the memory of Steve Schneider by continuing to fight for the things he fought for, by continuing to seek a clear understanding of the causes and impacts of climate change. We honor Steve by recognizing that communication is a vital part of our job. We honor Steve by taking the time to explain our research findings in plain English, by telling others what we do, why we do it, and why they should care about it. We honor Steve by raising our voices and speaking out when powerful forces of unreason seek to misrepresent our science. We honor Steve by caring about the strange and beautiful planet on which we live, by protecting its climate, and by ensuring that our policymakers do not fall asleep at the wheel. Here is Stephen Schneider in his own words back in 1979.
Since population is growing, since more people are demanding increased standards of living, since the use of energy is a major factor in increased standards of living, and since the principal energy source is fossil fuels, coal and oil and gas, projections suggest that CO2 is going to increase at an almost exponential rate over the next 20 to 50 years, and that sometime around the end of this century there'll be maybe a 20% increase in CO2 over now, and in the middle of the next century a doubling over now. That's a very large increase. Up till now, we've had this 7% increase. What will that do to the climate? Are there any signs? Are there any precursors? Do we see anything which indicates that there's any serious changes? And this is where controversy comes in. The scientific consensus that CO2 will build up and will be a potential problem is very large. But a scientific consensus on precisely how influential it will be in 10 years or 20 years, what areas climates will get better, what areas will get worse, this is where the controversy comes in. So what we're really doing is we're insulting our global environment at a faster rate than we're understanding it. And the best we can do, in all honesty, is say, look out, there's a chance of potentially irreversible change at a global scale based upon the benefits of use of energy. And it's very tough for us to know whether those benefits of energy today are worth the potential risks of environmental change for our children.
That was over 30 years ago, and he was right. Since then, we have learned a great deal. And the uncertainties Schneider spoke of in 1979 have been greatly reduced. We now know that climate change will not only affect the future, but that it is currently affecting the present. And that every day we delay, we only increase the difficulty of what must be done. Stephen Schneider will be deeply missed. The world is poorer without him. The fallout from ClimateGate and the vindication of scientists continues, this time at the Institute of Physics. First, a quick recap. Shortly after the crew email leak late last year, the Institute of Physics released a report which was very critical of the scientists whose private emails had just been stolen and made public. One of the major criticisms it leveled against the scientists was their lack of openness. What made this ironic is that the Institute of Physics refused to be open about who wrote the report, calling for more openness. This irony was not lost on a bunch of bloggers who, after some digging, discovered that the authors of this report were energy consultants whose views on climate change were decidedly unscientific. Well, that just won't do for a respected scientific institution like the Institute of Physics. And this week, they rectified the situation, stating, following the meeting of the Science Board on the 17th of June 2010, it is with great regret that we announce that the energy subgroup, which was responsible for the questionable report, is to be disbanded immediately. This, as you can imagine, is a direct consequence of the ClimateGate affair. This may be months late, but justice delayed is better than no justice at all. The phrase, save the planet, was never meant to be taken literally. This hunk of rock that we live on is incredibly old and resilient, and despite what we may do on its surface, the planet itself is in no danger. People who campaign under the Save the Planet banner, by and large, understand that the planet will be fine regardless of what humans do. Only a handful of wackos would disagree, and all of them should simply be ignored. However, some people who ought to know better, like Stanford University physicist and 1998 physics laureate Robert Laughlin, do take Save the Planet literally, and in doing so reveal their folly, saying in an article titled What the Earth Knows, published in the American Scholar, that common sense tells us that damaging a thing this old is somewhat easier to imagine than it is to accomplish, like invading Russia. The Earth has suffered mass volcanic explosions, floods, meteor impacts, mountain formations, and all manner of other abuses greater than anything people could inflict. And it is still here. It is a survivor. Now, the planet itself may be a survivor, but specific life forms are not. Dinosaurs, for example, did not survive, and there is no guarantee that we will survive. Lawlen goes on, the Earth plans to dissolve the bulk of this carbon dioxide into its oceans in about a millennium, leaving the concentration in the atmosphere slightly higher than today's. Over tens of millennia after that, or perhaps hundreds, it will then slowly transfer the excess carbon dioxide into its rocks, eventually returning levels in the sea and air to what they were before humans arrived on the scene. The process will take an eternity from the human perspective, but it will only be a brief instant of geologic time. Now, Lawlen is right, but we care about the human perspective. Looking at geologic time, the whole of human existence is but the blink of an eye, barely noticeable and completely insignificant. But to us, it is different. As Carl Sagan eloquently stated when describing a picture taken of Earth from so far away that the entire planet appeared as a single pixel.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on the mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world, To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
To us, the human perspective is everything. What happens in many thousands of years doesn't even begin to enter our minds as we plan for the future. Indeed, we can scarcely comprehend in our minds such a span. It is nothing more than an abstraction for us. If the excess carbon dioxide will be absorbed in several thousand years, or several million years, matters little. We, the human race, will have to live with the consequences of the excess CO2 for thousands of years or longer. And even that is longer than most of us can appreciate, even if it is nothing but a blink on geologic timescales. The error made by Lawlen is to equate the survival of the planet with the survival of life, or more specifically, with the well-being of human beings and human civilization. Using the same logic, I could state that World War II was no big deal because in time, all the damage it caused will be repaired. And for the most part, most of the damage already has been repaired. But that is small comfort for the people who went through an unimaginable hell during the war. The question isn't whether or not the planet will survive. The question isn't even whether we will survive. As a species, I have great confidence that even if we do nothing about climate change, we will survive. The question is how well we will survive. Will we continue to prosper, or will our civilization crumble under the worst plausible case scenario of climate change? That is the real question, and it has precious little to do with whether or not the planet survives. The phrase "save the planet" was never meant to be taken literally.
People often talk about a consensus of scientists. Maybe it would be more helpful if we paid more attention to the consensus of evidence. The case for man-made global warming isn't based on a show of hands, but on direct measurements. We're not talking about a single smoking gun, but multiple lines of evidence, independently pointing to the same answer. There's a consensus of evidence that humans are raising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. We're emitting around 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. Not surprisingly, some of it is staying up there. But in case you had any doubts that we're responsible for the rising carbon dioxide, we can double-check by measuring the type of carbon in the air. What we're finding is more of the carbon that comes from fossil fuels. This is a distinct human fingerprint. There's a consensus of evidence that all this extra carbon dioxide is causing warming. Satellites directly measure less heat escaping to space. Surface measurements find more heat returning to Earth. This is happening at exactly the wavelengths where CO2 traps heat. These are two more human fingerprints. There's a consensus of evidence that global warming is happening. Thermometers measure rising temperatures, and satellites find the same warming trend. Other signs of warming are found all over the globe: shrinking ice sheets, retreating glaciers, rising sea levels, migrating species, and shifting seasons. The pattern of warming reveal the telltale signatures of an increased greenhouse effect. Nights are warming faster than days. The lower atmosphere is warming, while the upper atmosphere is cooling. These are even more human fingerprints on climate change. On the question of whether humans are causing global warming, there's not just a consensus of scientists, there's a consensus of evidence.
That's it for this week's show. Show notes will be posted at irregularclimate.com. Also at the website, there are plenty of RSS feeds for subscribing to the podcast. We're also available in the iTunes Music Store and the Zune Marketplace. If you're there, why not rate us or write a review? We also have links to our Twitter and Facebook pages. Follow us and send us feedback. Tell us what we are doing well and what we need to work harder on. Also, if you feel so inclined and want to support the podcast, you can donate to Irregular Climate via PayPal. The links are all on the website. But if you are unable or unwilling to donate, please continue to download and listen. That in and of itself supports the show and helps it grow. And why not also tell a friend to download and listen? That'll help even more. I am Dan Mutol. You can follow me online at ofdan.ca, where you can find links to my blog, my Twitter feed, my Flickr feed, and everything else I do online. Thanks, and until next week, try and stay regular.